Hi, it's TJ Murphy, editor-in-chief of Triathlete Magazine. I am in the field today at Mountain Strength CrossFit here in a metro Boston area. And you may have been reading some of the blogging I've been doing, and we are currently working on a feature story. A key interest for me over the last 5 years has been myself and others, particularly like master's level runners and triathletes who've been at it a while. Some of us, due to injury that we can't seem to overcome, have opened our minds up to different ways of approaching the sport, which kind of led me to folks like Kelly Starrett and Brian McKenzie. And I, having recently moved to Boston, I started hearing really good things about Mountain Strength CrossFit. And as I've also written about CrossFit, there's a lot of affiliates around the world, but they're virtually none are the same. And sitting with me is the owner and founder of Mount Strength CrossFit, Rich Borgatti.
Yes.
Hi, Rich.
Hello.
Thanks for chatting with us. And, yep. And John Mariana, who has been coaching here for how long?
A little over 2 years.
A little over 2 years. And pretty interesting. These guys have a sort of varied background that I always find fascinating in the CrossFit world. Rich, you've got a track and field background, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And martial arts and more. And I should also mention that Rich has been coaching obstacle course racers since about the beginning of when Spartan really took off.
Yeah, I started my first obstacle course race client that I took on was in 2010.
So
7 years now of coaching obstacle course racing.
Yeah. And I would like a little history of Mountain Strength CrossFit. So that started 2009, 2010,
or originally conceived June 2008 was the very first I walked into the bank in City Hall and signed the papers saying this is an official thing. And we started off as a boot camp company outside. I had three locations with about 20 to 30 people each location. Just really getting people fit outside. Lots of burpees, lots of lunges, playground equipment, stuff like that. Eventually in 2010, I affiliated with CrossFit. I was already a CrossFit trainer in 2009. I was going to a CrossFit gym myself, CrossFit Boston, and doing private coaching at that gym. Eventually my outdoor clients really wanted to go inside when it snowed, because I didn't stop when the weather got bad. We were just out there. There was no change in the curriculum once the weather got bad. So I relented. I rented a few spaces, as every CrossFit affiliate in that time period knows. You kind of started off in a closet and worked your way up from there. So we rented a MMA gym that I trained at, and we went to a racquetball court. Then we got kicked out, went back to a park, and then we rented this location here in Winchester, which is about 3,600 square feet.
And one of the things you notice here is that you've got obstacle course racing specific kind of equipment too.
Yes.
Wall.
We have the practice wall. We have plyo boxes, which is normal for a CrossFit gym, peg wall, and few climbing implements on the rig, spears for throwing, stuff like that.
And John, I should mention that you've done some marathons yourself, along with a pretty varied athletic history.
I have. I was also track and field. I was a thrower.
Oh, is that right? Javelin or
discus and hammer, and then
the hammer throw.
Maybe a little lopsided. Gave me some shoulder issues on the right side. I don't have them on my left, especially the disc. But
it's interesting how the hammer throw is the one field event that's like held a mile from the track. Cool.
And then the coach stands behind the fence. After college, I kind of became a runner, medium distance, and then. In and out of gyms, was working a lot at that point. At that point in my life too, I started competitively racing cars, road course racing. I did that and I instructed as well, people taking their cars to racetracks and road courses. I did that for about 10 years, and then kids happened, and there was no longer time for that. And then I found mountain strength. I was just, you know, moved to Winchester, and I was looking around for something to get myself back involved with, to find a community, and I found here. And since I've been here and joined mountain strength, I've run 2 Boston marathons, lots of half marathons, Spartan races, Tough Mudders. Recently, I've kind of taken my focus of training to more powerlifting and strength.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, what's really interesting to me is that I think that in the last 10 years, at least per my observation, there's kind of been a shift, speaking specifically to the endurance athlete, where it used to be I'm going to go run my first marathon, and the traditional program was, okay, we'll build up as many miles as you can, build up your long run, maybe throw in a few stretches here and there, and do your marathon, and just do it over. This actually goes to the elite level, the top U.S. marathoner, Dathan Ritzenheim. He finished 3rd at Chicago Marathon a few years ago, and he was saying how he wished he'd done it differently. And if he ever coaches high school kids, he would do it differently, where rather than just start off and build you into a runner or a triathlete or an obstacle course racer, let's make you an athlete first, you know? And so that being the foundation, the real foundation of athletic performance or endurance performance, as opposed to this massive aerobic foundation that traditionally runners and triathletes sort of pursued. And I'm just curious, you guys are good examples of that. Martial arts, obstacle course racing, being able to jump into the Boston Marathon and do it without probably too much sports-specific stuff, or how would you go about doing that?
When I decided to start training for the marathon, you know, I realized at that point I still wanted to keep up with CrossFit, and I didn't want to have to drastically change too much because I wouldn't want to sacrifice what I had built in CrossFit over the previous 4 years. And so one run long a week, and I had one short recovery run, and the rest of the time was, you know, in the gym, weighted lunges, sled work, sled pulling, hill work, and I tried to maintain, you know, cut down on the amount of CrossFit classes, you know, 2, maybe 3 a week. Just a little more attention on mobility, you know, because of the amount of work that I was doing. It was, you know, your first marathon is always a massive learning curve. Second one, I even actually ran a little less to train for it. I had a much more successful second one as well. So,
you know, one of the things that's interesting to me about this is that, and we talked beforehand, that you've had a fair number of runners that have joined the gym over the years. Boston is a running town for sure. And
absolutely, yeah.
And I'm curious, one question a lot of, this is the question I had at the beginning for me. I get hurt doing this, and my observation over the years has been there are different sorts of CrossFit gyms that kind of have different sorts of bias. And one of the things that I, and why I'm talking to you guys now is that I saw immediately that you were one of the CrossFit affiliates that's really focused on this whole principle of virtuosity. You know, it wasn't about driving, you know, somebody walks into the box and you just crater them with some sort of workout that this high intensity image that CrossFit sometimes has, but rather this focus on learning the basic fundamental movements and doing them correctly with little or no load. And Rich, tell me your philosophy on that. Is that something that you came to really gravitate toward as you put more years into the gym, or is that something you kind of did off the bat?
Yeah, no, I made my mistakes in the beginning for sure. The very first year, I had to question a lot of what I was doing and how it worked for the athletes and the population that I wanted to work for and work with, what fit, what did best for them, and what fit my philosophy. Because when I came in, I was trying too hard in the beginning to be too much of something I wasn't believing in. right? You know, everybody does that in a way. You go too far left and then you go too far right and you kind of find your center. And it took me a few years to find where I belonged and where my center was. And that really came to a head when I decided to really embrace my running background and my running roots and to really chase performance, you know, of what I wanted to do and who I wanted to work with and what their goals were rather than what my goals for the gym were. And once that happened, things started to fall into place, and caring, you know, became a huge thing for me. Like, let me find out where you're going, how I can best help you, and let me go find the tools and make that as short a journey as possible for you.
Right.
Like, let's get you back out there, get you running, and use what I consider my expertise, being my large running background. And I've made my mistakes there. I've had so many injuries in the past from track and field and from cross country and road running that I'm good at making mistakes and fixing them and then making sure no one else makes those mistakes.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like a journey for me as well, and I figured it out along the way. And now I think it has permeated our culture, which is why so many runners, I think, are here at this gym.
Yeah, and I advice I have to you, my fellow runner and triathletes, that there's a bunch of guys I used to train with in San Francisco, and we did, you know, 60, 80, 100 miles a week, and we did marathons, and this is 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and very few of us are in good walking condition, let alone running condition, and for me it's been a very much a rebuilding process. But what was interesting to me is I think that with good coaches who have good eyes in the CrossFit world, that even in an on-ramp, you get some interesting feedback. Like when you see somebody come in to one of the first classes or into an on-ramp, and an on-ramp is kind of like a set of classes that CrossFit affiliates like Mount Strength CrossFit have to kind of introduce newcomers to the movements that are used in the workouts and things like that. But also you see immediately problems, right? Like somebody does an air squat, a simple bodyweight air squat, and you can see things going on. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, what that's like and what are you looking for when you see someone do some of these fundamental movements?
Yeah, so definitely the first time we see someone, we may not tell them, but it is an assessment. Like we're looking at how they move. We ask questions in our intake. We always try and schedule a one-on-one sit-down talk with people so we can kind of get a little bit more idea of what their day is like, what their profession is. And that would, some of those questions will tell us, okay, if they sit down at a desk all day, well, they may have shoulder issues, they may have shorter hip flexors, their glutes may not be firing properly. There are certain situations that lend itself to problems across the board. So when we go through this on-ramp, we look for these things. Are they coordinated head to toe? You know, can they put their arm over their head and lift their leg at the same time? Are they bilateral? Can they lunge without falling over? Can they sit? How far can they sit down? We're talking about a squat. A lot of runners have real problems just sitting down. Especially the more distance or junk miles you put in, the shorter your hip flexors get, the IT band issues, you just huge loss of mobility. So then that tells us where we need to focus on. Never mind throwing weight on a bar or having them lift. Like, we have to really work on mobility first, build them from the ground up, and then move on from there. So again, that caring, what works for them.
You know. And so if a runner comes in and or a triathlete and they say, well, like, and I know you just had a couple of members compete at Ironman Lake Placid recently.
Yeah, we had one of our coaches and one of our members together. They went and competed in Lake Placid this weekend. Yep.
So you can actually kind of steer their training towards specific goals like that. They're, you know, not qualifying for the CrossFit Games, rather sort of an almost impossible goal now.
But I think that goes to a big point of what's important is being flexible as a gym. I mean, we're not here to make you the best CrossFit athlete. We're here to take CrossFit, you know, and apply it to help you make you better at whatever you want to do. Other, you know, so if you're a runner, how can we take CrossFit and make you a better runner, healthier person? know, if you want to do an Ironman or you want to do any sport, really, you know, how do we take the principles of CrossFit, the moving, the training, and just make you better at what you want to do? And it doesn't necessarily have to, and not everyone has the same goal when they come in here.
The essential definition of CrossFit, whatever someone's perception might be, it's really based on those 10 athletic skills, mm-hmm. right? It's power, speed, mobility, accuracy, all of these mm-hmm. different sorts of skills. And the idea being that if you build up that foundation, you can probably apply it.
Yeah, you find you can, those 10 skills, which were, I think, originally written down by the founders of Dynamax Medicine Balls, but if you take that as a baseline and chart, like, a percentage of where people are there, you want to take their weakest links and at least bring it up to baseline, like, where their average should be, and then you can work on building everything more from that point. So, and we definitely take Greg Glassman's Play New Sports in his 100
right.
Words of Fitness. CrossFit's supposed to be used to chart your fitness to get better, and so you can do more things, go do other things. It's a general physical preparation program. It shouldn't, from this aspect, it shouldn't be the one-all, be-all.
Yeah.
It should fit into what you want to do.
One of the things that's sort of interesting to me is, like, when I first got into it, I was surprised, and there I was 47, I think, the first time I kind of stepped into a box, and I was limping, you know, and I was, I tried everything, mostly things like taping up my knee and taking as much Advil as I possibly could. I'm like, you know what, I've got no reason not to try something different. It's just, I want to keep banging my head on the wall, but I was surprised at how much general athletic capacity it was still, like, I would have really predicted it was gone, it was toast. There's certain things that I hadn't done since I was 20 or a high school football player.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, like, jumping onto a 30-inch box, which, you know, in the CrossFit world, that's pretty low, but for me, I was, like, astounded that I could actually do something like that. I just have to say, like, the gym here is a, like a lot of CrossFit affiliates, there's a board with kind of the PRs from these different workouts, these benchmark workouts and things, and you're on a lot of those, John, I just noticed. Not to mention a sub 5-minute Fran, which is pretty incredible to me. I can't imagine that.
Sub 4.
Yeah, you want to look, he has the fastest Fran time and the highest CrossFit total in the gym. So, I mean, that's something that Greg talked about years ago. We're going to have a fast mile runner, and we're going to have the strongest person. And you can combine the two. At the time, they were separate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, John, you really worked hard to connect the two. Huh?
Yeah. I'm just curious, how did you do that?
just not specializing too much in one thing.
Right.
You know? And that's the big thing. It's you know, a well-rounded athlete.
Yeah.
You know, be strong and be able to maintain speed. Can't sacrifice too much in one direction. Not over-specializing.
And you know, that actually reminds me of a point that Brian McKenzie, I heard in one of his original lectures that I found online that he talked about. And I can just see this happening. Like, somebody who's, say, done 6 Boston Marathons, their identity is as a runner.
Mm-hmm.
But they want to get into some sort of functional fitness program because injury troubles or
right.
maybe, and there's actually plenty of research to support this, like, if you don't train fast twitch muscle fiber, it's going to recede, and especially after the age of 40, and that even if your marathon is your thing, it's still going to affect how efficient you are and things like that. But McKenzie was saying that traditional kind of runner type, triathlon type that I certainly was, comes in and goes, well, this is cool. Can I do 3 or 4 of these workouts a week and do my 80 miles a week? And McKenzie's like, that is just not going to work, you know?
No.
Have you had any experience with that or any insight on that, on what kind of the right composition is?
Yeah, I think, John, you played around a lot of that during your marathon. We were, you know,
balance and rest. I mean, especially as you get into older athletes, and we struggle this on a daily basis, because we do have a lot of runners, and and running can become a psychological, have a strong psychological component where people don't feel like they're running, you know, 3-4 times a week or putting in the amount of miles that they're getting less fit or they're going to put on too much weight.
It's weird.
Or,
I've had that.
And what they don't realize is, you know, rest and work go hand in hand. The more you work out, the more you need to rest, and there's only so many hours in a week.
Mm-hmm.
So if you become too out of balance, you're just going to go nowhere or down. So it's very important. That's why sometimes to make, you know, broad progress everywhere sometimes means slower progress, you know, and then again you're batting another psychological opponent where a lot of people would rather be the best at one thing and be, you know, sacrifice everywhere else than just kind of be kind of good everywhere. Because again, it goes back to what you said, the identity thing. If you're going to have an identity, you'd rather be, okay, I'm the best at this. You know, they may be able to beat me in, you know, back squat and handstands and, you know, muscle, whatever it is, but I can go out and run a fast 5K, faster than anyone else. So your identity really becomes a runner. So there's definitely a lot of psychological components that come with that impact. Just someone being able to moderate themselves and not try to do too much.
Yeah, this whole less is more kind of principle can.
Yeah.
And I actually, we had a workout just before we sat down to talk, and John was coaching, and it was the primary movement, it was using a rower, and there was a member who was, you pointed him out to me because John was helping with my form, and that's one of the big things that I've really come to like about good CrossFit coaching is that there's just no way you can do that stuff on your own. You can't see yourself, and your mind lies to you. Like I know that in my mind's eye, when I first met somebody like Kelly Starrett, that I had this perfect air squat. But if somebody videotaped it and showed it to me, I was just horrified. I'm like, I look like a broken insect. But you pointed out one of the other members who was just amazingly. They made it look so easy, but he was generating so much power from this very efficient, relaxed stroke, and that you can apply that to pretty much every movement. But I think that's an interesting thing, like this whole idea of funneling power from the core to the extremity with a lot of efficiency, certainly for the traffic who's swimming, biking, and running, working on that mechanism is gonna turn out to have more performance, not just injury prevention, but actually more performance. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really look at strength as being the, you know, if you have enough strength, everything else is going to be easier. But a lot of times when you get into a monostructural sport like just running or just rowing or just biking or swimming, it's catabolic. It's muscle wasting after some time. And so the body gets really, really efficiently at staying in that zone and pushing hard cardiovascularly rather than muscular. But if you add strength to that cardiovascular engine, you're going to be much more powerful. You're going to go harder, longer, be safer, be able to recover from mishaps, like falling off the bike. Like if you have no muscle protecting your bones, you're just going to break something.
Right.
Right. You'd be able to get back on the bike and go if you have more muscle mass. So it's definitely something that I tell my athletes, especially in obstacle course racing, where, you know, they get focused on running, like I got to run more too, you know, because it's still a running sport. But more muscle means you can go harder, longer, and have less injuries. So they have to go balanced hand in hand rather than sticking, as John said, specializing in one direction. You end up losing a lot of other benefits.
And when you drop off the top of that 10-foot wall, you better make sure your legs are strong enough to absorb your body weight. You know, so, you know, if they're not, you're going to start causing some long-term damage, you know. So you want to be able to squat, you know, one and a half times your body weight before you think about really jumping off a 10-foot wall.
And there's other really interesting things along with, I don't think I'd have been upside down in, I don't know, 20 years. And then obviously one of the basics that you're introduced to in a standard CrossFit program eventually is like a handstand and things like that. And at first it was super weird. Like, I just hadn't done anything like that in so long. But it's you know, rather than, you know, when you're training for an Ironman, traditionally you're going in a straight line in three different ways, you know, very much cardiovascular based activity, and you're not moving side to side, and so you kind of, I certainly lost a lot of proprioception. Is that mm-hmm. the right word?
That where you are in space. Yeah.
And that, you know, it maybe doesn't automatically connect, like, why, how's that going to benefit me in an endurance sport? But it does. And along with just the other thing I kind of picked up on and being reminded of, you know, having become a member here, is just the language of movement. And it's funny how before and after, like, I was around a lot of runners and I didn't really notice anything about people's form. But after you've kind of been through this process, you really see things like, oh my, look at the knees cave in on that runner, you know, and you just know what, in fact, you almost feel the pain now because you understand the language. Is that, it's kind of an interesting thing too, like you talked about the squat. It's not just being able to do 1.5 times your body weight, but to do it in a way where you're loading properly and you're not, a lot of runners might be worried about doing squats because, oh, it'll wreck my knees, but if you do it right, it's not going to wreck your knees.
Absolutely.
Now,
once you've trained your eye to see certain things, it's hard to unsee it. I'll drive around the local lake here where a lot of runners go out and run, and sometimes I just drive by and I just cringe. And I'm like,
you just see the surgeries being cooked up.
Oh, yeah.
And then I found this interesting, going through the on-ramp process with you, Rich, and that you saw some really detailed things, and that, I chatted with you about that, but you mentioned that your martial arts background kind of played into that.
Yeah, so a lot of minute movements. Speed masks a lot of inefficiencies in the body. So when you start slowing things down, you start seeing a few things. But in martial arts, everything gets sped up. And if you don't have an eye for detail, like really quick changes of direction or certain angles, you're just going to get hit. So that's helped me a lot in noticing movement deficiencies in people that I coach. What's firing first? You know, is it coming from, which joints are coming from? Are their hips moving? Are their shoulders moving? Because you can generally avoid a lot of getting punched in the face in martial arts if you have an eye for where their hips are. Hmm. Where you are moving wherever your hips are going. That's helped out a lot, especially with runners too. And that's why if you look at runners, if their hips are swaying side to side, their sense of balance is completely off. And you're loading, like John was talking about, loading up the legs. Every time you run, you know, you got 1.5 times your body weight on per leg. And so if you have a lot of sway to your body, you're loading not only that load, but torque into the joint. To back up, that's how martial arts has helped me identify a lot of torque and load into the body and which direction it's going. So,
but for whatever reason, maybe that just if you rely simply on, okay, if you're a distance runner, just on running, over time you might not notice, but this certainly happened to me. Yeah. I don't think I ever engaged my core muscles when I ran. I never thought about it. I think at the end I was kind of just using my hip flexors and to run, you know.
Yeah.
But you've got these large muscle groups that if you kind of learn how to use this core to extremity loading process or energy process, there's not only more power there, but you can go longer. They're larger muscles. They don't burn out quite as fast. And I think for something like the Ironman, that where you're in this terrible position on a time trial position on a bike for hours, and then you've got to hop off that and run a marathon. You know, to be able to, if those big muscles are just not really being tapped to their full potential, you're kind of like leaving a lot of performance on the table. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's kind of like what I was just saying, speed masks inefficiencies.
Yeah.
Same thing if you're tired and not engaging other core muscles, then you're leaving stuff on the table. And little muscles end up taking the brunt of that, and that's where we get ligament tears, things of that nature, because you're relying on support muscles that are doing a job they're not supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
So we see that a lot in shoulders and in hips. Shoulders and hip flexors tend to be that. Runners tend to be very quad-centric, bikers obviously too. But if you usually we find that if we teach them how to engage their hamstrings and their glutes in a more efficient manner, usually by engaging the core, will help. They all work together. Then they find that they're faster and they're better at than previously, and they're not working as hard. Like, oh, this is easier, but they're not going in. They're not doing their gait isn't different. Their leg speed isn't different. They're just using bigger muscle groups and able to stay longer.
Right.
So, and it's funny when you tell especially a long distance runner to push their hips forward. Like, here, let's change your center of gravity slightly. Let's move this forward. Everything becomes easier. But you can't shift into that position without engaging some abdominals and glutes. And yet they get faster and better, and they're not doing anything different. It's technique versus inefficiency. Right.
And sort of build some of that stuff. There was an article written by formerly the editor-in-chief of Running Times, then he's been a contributor to Runner's World for a long time, Scott Douglas. I think he might still be up in Maine, but he'd written a critical article about CrossFit for runners, and he used, pretty much believe that he's never stepped inside a CrossFit gym, which has kind of been my, have problems with criticizing any sort of type of training or giving a good analysis, but you got to at least see what you're talking about. And what he did was he analyzed the workout Cindy, which is a benchmark workout. We actually just had it here a couple of days ago. It's essentially a body weight workout, 20 minutes of squats, pull-ups, and push-ups, and he argued that a runner is better off just going for a 20-minute run rather than doing that workout, which I found perplexing. I'm like, why not at least even just once a week, like doing something like that? Because what from a coach's perspective, what does an athlete kind of get in terms of a training impact from that workout like Cindy? Like, what's the stimulus?
What a runner would get out of that, it's 20 minutes, so we are hitting the cardiovascular window. It is still aerobic. It's still an aerobic, so you're still getting the same aerobic capacity out of that. But we are switching muscle groups. A lot of runners can benefit from the pulling and pushing in that workout, so it's got five pull-ups, correct, and then 10 push-ups, and then 15 squats. So pull-push, a lot of runners have a very, very weak upper body, especially in the upper shoulders, they get caved in. And the runners I've talked to also have problems with upper back pain too. So if we start strengthening that area over time, and this is low impact, it can be low volume for them too, is that they tend to stand up, postures better, shoulders can get pulled back. When your posture is better, you're actually more efficient, you run better.
Breathe better.
You breathe better, yeah. You're not caving in on the diaphragm. Then just the pure leg strength. They actually might, most runners, if they're a good long distance runner, may not feel too much impact from 15 squats at once, but over 20 minutes they're gonna start to feel that and keep their hips loose, strengthens the hip flexors, engages the glutes and hamstrings over staying quad-centric, and embraces the core. All three movements there, you need the core tight to make working.
Right.
And it's upper and lower body at the same time. So you're getting a good coordination workout out of my arms are tired, from pulling, and now I'm pushing, so I'm coordinating two concentric groups of muscles. Or complementary muscle groups, and then the legs, if my core is weak, I'm going to collapse on those squats. And so I really got to try and keep my torso upright. So there's a lot of benefit of it. On the outset, you look at it and be like, that has nothing to do with running. It's just pull, push, squat. But it's not. On the physiological side, you're doing a lot for your body.
And to circle back to what we originally talked to you about, when I, your racer's mindset goes off with these sorts of workouts, but what I appreciate what you guys do here is that, like John came over, made sure I focused on the form of the squat, which is a big weakness for me, you know, and to, it was Starrett or someone who's just, the first I heard this from, but finding those weaknesses is a kind of a blessing in disguise, because if you can turn a weakness into a strength, you're going to get this pocket of performance gain and health and benefits that you've been missing out on. But in other words, so it wasn't just simply kind of a metabolic workout, but it was all he was also making me focus on the technique, better movement patterns, mobility, kind of being the upshot there.
Yeah, absolutely. As a coach, that's you look at that, and your competitive side can come out and say, like, I want to do more work than the person next to me, but that's not really the point. It's do more work better than yourself, right? Perfect for, you know, the first time I did Cindy, I think I did it extremely slow for that point, right? I want to get every movement done well, do strict pull-ups, not kipping pull-ups, do really strict push-ups, you know, and really, really well-done squats. And then as you get better, you're like, okay, I'm good here. And then you ramp up the intensity once your form is dialed in. You can't go the other way. And runners do this all the time. Everybody runs because they've always run, not because they learned how to run. A lot of people go backwards, have to relearn how to run properly, and then they find the benefit out of it.
Yeah.
If people just started off with building some good form, some strength, and then went into a sport, they'd find that athleticism you talked about earlier would last a lot longer. They wouldn't have to backtrack and, you know, regress. So,
and to add some fun to it and to shift gears a little bit, and I won't keep you guys too much longer, but I'm training now for my first obstacle course race, which is in November. Yeah. And I've got this premise that I think certainly good for me, but perhaps other triathletes and runners who might be following the writing I do on this, but kind of a really cool off-season thing to do to kind of restore some athletic capacity, give yourself a break from an endurance grind, is training for one of these short obstacle course races, because it makes it fun. For all you're incorporating these things we've been talking about, like more all around athletic capacity, but it's a little scary too, I gotta admit. Like, you just kind of scared me, this 10-foot wall thing. I don't want to break a leg or anything, but
hey man, an open water swim scares me. All right,
fair enough.
So
fair enough.
Like, some of those guys in Kona, I'm like, I'm not going out there.
Well, what's cool? Cool thing is that you really your history and the history of the gym, you've got quite a lore in terms of like learning how to coach this whole basically brand new branch of endurance sports, which is obstacle course racing, and someone I've come to know, a really terrific age group triathlete named Kevin Flowers, who's out, I think, in the Santa Cruz area, but he's become a pretty terrific obstacle course racer. I mean, he was like one of the best age groupers in the sport of triathlon over the past 20 years, and did really well at Ironman and also the Boston Marathon as a runner. But now his thing is Spartan racing, and I wonder if you could maybe just share some basic tips on, like, if a triathlete or a runner were to walk in here and go, hey, you know, I'd like to do an obstacle course race, what would be your guidance getting them from wherever they're coming at, which could obviously be a million different places in terms of history with injuries and such, but is it doable, and how do you do it in a safe and smart way?
Yeah, it's absolutely doable. One of the first things, if we don't talk to like the history of the specific athlete, we just say they're in good health and they're ready to go, it would be lateral support. How good are their lateral support? You know, can they go side to side? Can they start stop? Can they push pull? Can they put their arms over their head? You know, because in these races there's a lot of brachiation, which is just hanging. It's a fancy word for hanging, and climbing with stuff over. So my first inclination would be to make sure that their range of motion and their joints are safe for these events.
Right.
And then we would move on to practicing certain obstacles, starting from, you know, rope climbing to wall climbing to crawling, to throwing, things like that. So it's just some simple things to start off with that are really fun to do, then just building off there. And then you can put them into circuits and make make them more race-like.
Right.
And add some people and you have a party.
You've both been your share of obstacle course racing, it sounds like.
Yep, I've got 7 years of racing. I'm just about to do my third Spartan Beast. I got a Spartan Super next weekend, it's been a lot of fun so far. And not all of it has been like injury free either. So like you know, these things do happen, and but I've come back and been able to race them fairly well. Coach a lot of people through these races. I think every year I coach probably about 30 to 40 people to a race every year. So it's a lot of fun. And John is definitely one of my first
We did our first beast together.
We did our first beast together, yes.
And what does the beast entail? It's how many miles of
it's running? It's roughly a half marathon.
Yeah.
And we did the one in Killington, which is its own animal.
So. I've been reading the books by Joe Desana.
Desana, yeah.
Yeah. Sounds like quite a guy. He pretty interesting. Like he grew up in Queens, and his first business was cleaning pools, and then he went to Wall Street, and then he became an adventure racer, and then he just started suffering a lot. It seems like.
Yeah. Yeah. Not many people choose to run the Iditarod without dogs.
Yes.
So
on a diet of olive oil.
Yes.
Yeah. And you've spent some. You learn about the farm and the barn and you know how he's raising his kids, which is pretty intense as well.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I spent a weekend up at Eppa's barn and part of. One of my tests to become a level 2 Spartan coach. They don't do this anymore. We were the only group that they did this with, but we went up to Joe's house and surprise, we had the head of Panasonic there. We had like Joe, his whole family, his kids, a few other like people just there for the weekend. And I had to teach about 30 people a fitness class out in his backyard. And which was great, it was fantastic, but I'm right there getting scrutinized by Joe and his whole family. And every time I said to, okay, we're going to do like 10 push-ups, he's like, we're doing 30. I'm like, all right, okay, it's your house, Joe. We're doing 30 push-ups. Let's go. Then he challenged us. He's like, grab the heaviest thing you can. And we're going, he has a mountain in his backyard,
yeah.
Joe's mountain. And we just grabbed tree logs and I'm talking like telephone pole size things, and we carried it all the way up the mountain. And that's just how it is. It's like you're either going to show me how much you suffer or you can go home. pretty much how Joe DeSena is, or at least from that meeting.
I forget the name of one of his first athletes, but it's showcased in the book. They did like 100 miles. He actually is a former Ironman triathlete, and I think he broke his hip at Ironman Louisville, and somehow they met because they switched passports accidentally on an airplane flight, and that's how they met. And I'm forgetting the guy's name, but it's a brutal piece of writing. I've suffered to hear about what Joe put this guy through. It's 100 miles up and down the mountain.
Oh yeah.
You know, and he's like sleeping in some chicken coop to stay warm.
Yeah, yeah. There's a cabin at the top of that mountain that many people have slept in. Yeah, just don't want to come back down the mountain. But yeah, so that's how the whole, most people start a race series with a 5K and build up, right?
Yeah.
He started with something called the Death Race and worked his way down to a 5K. So that just kind of, that's kind of the mentality of let's go hard and let's see how much we can take. So, but the beast, John and I did the beast, and that was, at Killington, eight hours it took us for our first time, and it was just up and down the mountain, and
wow,
lots of obstacles, and yeah, it was dark. We almost got kicked off. We were, as most racers, we were a little egotistical, I think, at the beginning. We're like, we'll be done in 4 or 5 hours, and the elites took 4.5 hours to finish the race, and it was our first time. It was 8 hours, and we were out there in the dark.
It was one of those ones where we, you know, crossed the finish line. I'm like, I'm never doing this again. And I think after a beer and a hamburger, I'm like, so when are we signing up?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. That was the best of times, the worst of times.
Look forward to coming and cheering you guys on soon. But I'm kind of psyched. I just like to. So the Spartan Sprint that I'm doing is at Fenway.
Yeah, the Stadium Series. Yeah.
Yeah, which I'm kind of a.
This is the series that's the most fun.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And there's an accessibility factor too. Like, you know, from what I'm reading, like it's relatively something that somebody who's got a good base of fitness from running and triathlons probably, and they do the right kind of transition training, can probably do okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's only 2.5 miles long, because you can only go so long inside a baseball or a football field.
Yeah.
But it's very obstacle laden. There's lots of challenges to
right.
do. It's very accessible to most people to do it.
Yeah, there's very few sections where you're actually in a sprint,
because
it's a lot of going up and down stairs around quarters and stuff like that. So it doesn't have the kind of like full out running requirement that you know. Typical outdoor obstacle course would have. You're not going to make up much time between obstacles at Fenway, because you just only go so fast up and down stairs.
It's made longer Spartan races. I think having a strong running
backer
is going to help you. You know,
especially if you can go up and down mountain. They try and put them on some pretty steep terrain.
Yeah.
So if you have strong legs and you can haul up a mountain, then you'll do well.
Or if you're skilled running downhill.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have a feature on kind of how to do this, incorporating what I've been learning from these guys. It'll be in our October issue. And you'll also, I'll put some links in the show notes here to Mount Strength CrossFit, but also there was an article in the Death Race. I think it's pretty fun to read. I read it years ago, and I kind of want to reread it now. We got sort of talking about it, but thanks so much for talking with us, guys. I just want to again say that if you're in the Boston area, it's one of the CrossFit affiliates I highly recommend. You're not going to get pushed over a cliff here. It's a good place to learn how to do this well and get the most out of it. But thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you,
cool.
TJ.
Thank you, TJ.